Okay, shall we start? Can everyone hear me? Hello? Okay, this is it's the weirdest shaped room that I've ever spoken at. So first of all, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for being here, particularly on a day with the weather like it is. Thank you for investing a couple of hours of your time with us, and hopefully we'll make it worth your while. The idea is to make this as interactive as possible, and for us to keep on looking right and left in this manner. So there's a microphone at each of your seats, and so we'll open it up as quickly as possible. Quickly about myself. So my name is Lutfi Siddiqui. I'm a visiting professor in practice here at LSE Ideas, and I'm also a member of the advisory board of the Systemic Risk Center. I should add that LSE Ideas has just been named the number one university-affiliated think tank in the world. So I'm obliged to mention that. I did say number one, right? So that's So today's panel, this event asks the question as to whether the private sector can rise to the challenge of meeting the 2030 UN Sustainable Development Goals. We're almost 5 years into the 15-year trek into towards the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and the role of business in delivering social outcomes is very much on the spotlight. What's also happened in recent months is that the buzzword, stakeholder capitalism, has taken hold, hopefully a bit of a bandwagon, and so that has also intensified focus on the role of business in delivering social outcomes. What we also had towards the middle of last year is the Business Roundtable in the US issuing a groundbreaking declaration that says that it's no longer shareholder primacy, that it's no longer just a case of the business of business is business, that we need to look at wider stakeholder considerations. And about a month later, when the UN General Assembly met, I watched PETA and Accenture. They've been working with the UN for some time to come up with the world's largest CEO study, which is an appraisal, in a way a self-appraisal, of how businesses are doing in terms of execution against the SDGs. So we thought it might be a good point to try and take stock of how things are going. What is the state of play? Are businesses on track to deliver on their side of the bargain? If not, why not? What are the shortcomings? What are the pitfalls? Can businesses really rise up to the challenge? So that's the idea. I would also hope that today we'll take a very positive and constructive bent. So on a topic like this, it's very easy to go into a whinge fest very, very quickly. So my appeal to you would be that let's try and keep things with the idea that how do we take things forward? So every time we feel like whinging, let's try and rephrase it as what it should look like in our ideal world. And so, as I said, let's keep it as positive and constructive as possible. So let's move straight to our distinguished speakers. It really is, I was looking at the perspectives that each one of them brings to this topic, and each one of them could do a public lecture here on their own right. Each one is a role model. And so this really is like the Avengers assembling. And I think, you know, each one of you should adopt a Marvel character. By the end of today, I'm Nick Fury, so it gives me huge delight to watch this assembly of stars. I'll introduce the speakers one by one. Before I do that, I see that my bosses for the day, Owen and Dave Sutton, want me to make some housekeeping points. So here goes. First of all, there's no scheduled fire drill, so if we hear the alarm, it's probably the real thing, so we'll need to leave. Secondly, the event is being filmed and recorded. The video and the podcast will likely be available from our webpage in the next few days, and photos will be taken. So I hope that that's not an issue, but that's what's happening. There are feedback forms placed at the table, and if you wouldn't mind filling them out at some point, and they give them to one of the stewards at the door as you leave, that would be great. And then lastly, there'll be a drinks reception outside just afterwards. So if you'd like to stick around and continue the conversation over drinks, that would be great. Could I also get a quick show of hands? How many people here are intending to ask questions before we even get into it? Right, okay. So that's the market before trading begins. Hopefully it'll go up. We have 5 Kindles, courtesy Peter Lacey. So I was told that I should give a Kindle each the 5 best questions that are asked. The catch is that it contains Peter's new book in it, which is...
There's such a thing as a free question.
Which is great, obviously. All right, so let me introduce Peter Lacey. Peter is a senior partner at Accenture. He leads the UK and Ireland practice and the global sustainability practice. And also, he leads the firm's partnerships with organizations such as the World Economic Forum and the United Nations. When I first met him and Lucy, his wife, they lived in Shanghai. And Peter was... Actually, you were running the global sustainability practice from Shanghai at the time, in addition to heading up cross-industry strategy for Asia-Pacific. And in 2017, Peter became the youngest ever senior managing director at Accenture and a member of Accenture's Global Leadership Council. So without further ado, Peter Lacey, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. This is my first ever session in the LSE format, I'm told this is, parliamentary or LSE, but great to have a chance to talk to you all. Thank you for making time this evening. I hope we're in for an engaging dialogue. I wanted to stay extremely task-focused to tee up the conversation this evening and to answer the question straight off the bat, which is, the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, can businesses rise to the challenge? And the answer is yes, but they have not to date. And I want to give you a few thoughts on why that may be about to change and how we go, to use your point about constructive narratives, about how we go about accelerating both the scale and the speed of that change, at the importance of what I think will be one of the most important 10 years for humanity that we've seen in recent centuries. So that's the first bit. What I will say, basically, in essence, that's the short version. I have been working on sustainability now for around 20 years in different formats. Like some of the others in the audience, I've spanned boundaries. I've worked on the NGO side, I've worked on policy side, I've worked in consulting and in business. And although I'm a pretty classically trained strategist by background, I've always felt that the most interesting dynamic for society as a whole is this relationship between business and society. And I would have said up until this year, up until even January, if you'd have asked me, will we make material progress in the next decade towards the global goals, I would have given you a pretty cautious and probably pretty pessimistic view. And in the last 6 to 8 weeks alone, I think something has happened and something is changing. And I've said that, I've been very public about that. And I'll tell you what I think it is. I think that there is a growing realization, not just perhaps in leadership roles in businesses that were already very positive about sustainability, but actually, I think it's starting to move further into the mainstream in different sectors, even in the last few weeks and months, I would argue. And it really hit me at Davos this year. As Lutfi mentioned, I look after our World Economic Forum relationship, and I've been going now for more than a decade to Davos. And Davos is not everyone's cup of tea, but it is one of the places that everyone comes together, or at least a very large number of heads of state and business leaders come together at the beginning of the year to look at what the next 12 months might bring, but also to discuss some of the bigger, more systematic and systemic issues that face business, that face the global economy, that face policymakers around the world. This year, it was a very different discussion than I've ever witnessed before. And I think I would describe it as a growing realization that this is the decade to deliver. The decade to deliver. And I would say that is against the backdrop, and I'll tell you what I mean by the decade to deliver in a minute. But I would say that is against the backdrop of some really quite important symbolism. But I think symbolism does matter a lot to our narratives, and particularly narratives of the nature that we're talking about here in terms of sustainability. So what are some of those? The United Nations was 75, or will be 75 this year. The World Economic Forum itself will be 50 this year. Two different pillars of a global order, a multilateral global order that emerged after the Second World War, and I think actually that are very much under threat, that are seeing a huge backlash in many different ways against the impact that they've had and against the results that have been delivered through that order over the last 60, 70, 80 years. And I think that is also against the backdrop of that 10-year story of what we're going to be looking for in 2030 by way of sustainable development. So I think it was a pause for thought for a lot of business leaders at Davos and at the beginning of the year to step back and think about this next decade. When I talk about the decade to deliver, I think I mean three things. One is that I think increasingly my clients, who are mostly CEOs of big Fortune 500, Global 2000 clients, companies, they talk about, and I think they increasingly recognize, that the system we have, globalization and capitalism at the moment, is really fragile. And we see that in terms of the political backlash that we've seen with Trump, with Brexit, see it in Italy. We see it even in places like China, where they're under incredible pressure to deliver in terms of capitalism, the jobs, the growth, the stability of the system. And we see that if we look back over the last 40 years, this is a system that has delivered for the few, not the many. And we can see that across the board in terms of the average wages increases. We see it in terms of the quality of jobs. We see it in terms of this strong sense that there has been a polarizing effect and an asymmetry of benefits in the system that we've chosen to pursue. And business can only thrive if it's thriving in a global system that is also thriving, or thriving in markets and in countries that are also thriving. And I think that is really beginning to be something that becomes at the forefront, not at the back of the minds of CEOs. Because this last 5 years has been pretty turbulent. It's been pretty aggressively turbulent on lots of different levels. Now, you can say, well, look, is that something that's coming from a morality perspective, from a values perspective? In some cases, yes. In others, the kinds of transitions and the kinds of dynamics emerging in things like global trade, in flows of migration and people around the world, even if you just take that as a pure economics issue, a pure business issue, it is starting to undermine the way this system works, and it needs to be resolved and it needs to be evolved to improve. So that's the first decade to deliver theme, is to deliver a model of globalization and capitalism that actually is sustainable. I think the second version of that story is a decade to deliver on technology. And we've talked a lot over the last decade about the fourth industrial revolution. You know, there's been all sorts of conversations about the physical, biological, digital technologies that are emerging, everything from artificial intelligence to decoding the human genome, and how those technologies hold enormous promise for creating new forms of value for people, health, education, productivity, labor, wage increases. Now, the truth is, that hasn't been the case. There has not been a fourth industrial revolution in the last decade. If you just look at the absolute basic economics of what we've been going through, you know, chugging along at 3%, 4% global growth, a revolution, an industrial revolution, changes the nature of the economy, changes the productive capacity of an economy. We have not seen that. So technology and the promise of technology has not delivered. Neither has it delivered for the many rather than the few. If you look at the extraordinary concentration of wealth over that period of time, it is to very few technology players, software players, platform players, the likes of the Amazons, the Googles, the Facebooks. Yeah, and actually what we see is even in businesses, most of the value is accrued to a small number of players, let alone in society as a whole. I believe personally that there is the potential for the fourth industrial revolution. I think we can see the technologies and the combinations that will allow us to enter a new era through those technologies. But this decade now has to be the decade where that becomes a reality. And we really do see a fourth industrial revolution. And that industrial revolution is put to use in a way that benefits the many, not the few. And then we come to the third component of the decade to deliver, which is that we must deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals, the global goals, our 17 goals, 163 sub-targets that were signed up to 4 years ago by 192 governments around the world in probably one of the most extensive stakeholder consultations with business that we've seen from the UN process that map out a pathway to what we need to do to achieve a turnaround in sustainable development. And when you look at that and take another step, you realize that business has to be at the heart of that. If it isn't at the heart of that, there is zero chance of us achieving it. So I'll give you a few statistics. I was with the CEO of Bank of America recently, Brian Moynihan, who talks, I'm sure Julie probably has similar figures, who talks about the fact that every year to 2030, to deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals, we will need to invest $6 trillion globally. And at the moment, if you add up what's committed from government spending and from philanthropic and charitable spending, you get to about $1.4 trillion. So even at the beginning of the decade, we're $4.5 trillion light in terms of the investments that are required in infrastructure, in transformations, in energy, in material sciences to deliver this, the Sustainable Development Goals. Now, on the one hand, you say, well, that is a massive systemic failure. And on the one hand, it is. But also, the way I look at it is an enormous opportunity for capital markets and for business to provide the products and the services and the new innovations and business models that allow us to bridge that gap. And by the way, that is not to deny the need for regulation or policy, because we can accelerate those areas with things like having carbon pricing through tax, through cap and trade. And we can stimulate the market in different ways to achieve that. But somewhere we've got to get from 1.4 trillion to 6 trillion. And also, all of you know the way that economics and investment work, we can't afford to be behind in the first 5 years and try and play catch up in the second. You know, that is just a fact that we know we'll need to be seeing businesses step up right across the world. Now, here's the bad news. Maybe that wasn't bad enough news. I've not been very constructive and positive, have I? But we'll lay this out. Right? The bad news is, we are off on every single one bar two of the SDGs as we start the decade. Maternal health and in some form economic well-being. And every other example is off track. The UN Secretary General says that if we carry on at this current trajectory, that we will achieve only 50% of the Sustainable Development Goals, even factoring in the investments that are included and that have already been committed. We will only achieve 50%. And you only have to see, I think, what's going on increasingly in places around the world, whether you see the wildfires in California, you see Australia. We get into points and tipping points and planetary boundaries where, you know, this is becoming irreversible and becoming very, very existentially frightening for a lot of people. And the best of the science tells us we simply can't afford not to deliver on that kind of trajectory on some of those goals over the next 10 years. So that's my starting point, and I believe, and I've seen this myself, okay, an example for Julie would be, I've had, since Davos, I have had five times more spanking CEOs call me this month than 3 months ago, right? And if you look across the board, the demand to want to have proper conversations at the beginning of this year is four, five, maybe even 10 times more than we've seen before. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily converting into action. I'm not going to say that that means that we are seeing a sea shift yet, because that has to be measured in results. But it seems something is changing. Now, when we talk about the CEO study that Lutfi mentioned, which we've got a few copies of, I think. For those of you, there's a box here with some copies. There's half a dozen copies here. But you can get it online. This is the result of a project that I've done now for 15 years for each of the last three UN Secretary Generals. Firstly for Kofi Annan, then for Ban Ki-moon, and now more recently for Guterres. And the study aims to give the UN leadership a chance to, every 3 years, take the temperature, almost a weather vane, if you like, for what business leaders are talking about, what they're focused on, what they think are the challenges, what are the opportunities, to enable the UN system to better work with business on some of these challenges. And this time round, which we presented this, as you rightly said, in the Climate Week in the UN in September of last year, we had the largest sample size to date. So we had 1,000 CEOs from more than 20 industries, from nearly 100 countries around the world. And I will just give you a couple of insights as to why I think it's changed, but why we've still got plenty of challenges ahead, and tee that up for the conversation in the group. This CEO study was very interesting for me. 3 points. One, for the first time, I saw a deep self-reflection from CEOs that they weren't delivering on the Sustainable Development Agenda, described by themselves rather than described by others. So out of those 1,000 CEOs, only 21% of those CEOs told us that they thought that they were having a material and critical positive impact on sustainable development through their core business. So 4/5 said that their business was not making the progress that they should be making on sustainable development. And that's not us saying that, that's them saying that. So 4/5 of, you're pointing at me to do something, or her to do something, right? Okay. 4/5 of CEOs don't believe that they're doing enough, right? Now, the second thing is, though, that's interesting is they believe they have enough firepower, enough tools at hand to deliver against this agenda. So if you ask them, do you believe that you need new technologies that don't exist? Do you need new business models that don't exist? Do you need something somehow that we need to reinvent? They will say no. They will say they don't have the right regulatory and policy frameworks in place. They will say that they have competing strategic priorities. They will say that they have different demands from different shareholders, some of whom will say with one voice that they want them to push very hard on sustainability, and others who will say yes, but not if it costs more, right? And there are lots of other tensions in the system, but the good news is that 40% of those CEOs told us they're already driving revenue growth out of sustainability, and 35% told us that they're already better able to manage their cost base through driving down emissions, driving down energy use, water waste, through building trust. 72% of CEOs told us that trust was the critical driver for them, building trust with societies to be able to innovate together, to have the license to operate, to license to grow. And so I think one positive thing to take away is that a lot of companies are already making a very good fist of this. And a lot of CEOs believe all of the different pieces of the jigsaw are there, but we're not putting it together in the right way. And we're certainly not putting it together in the right way at the right speed that matches the scale of the challenges. And then the third thing I'll leave you with is, and it comes back full circle, if you like, to the technology conversation, is most CEOs feel very nervous about the next 3 to 5 years because of the political uncertainty that exists at a global level that may well inhibit our ability to mobilize at scale in the ways that we might want to around sustainable development. So 63% of CEOs, the highest number we've ever had, said that political uncertainty was their greatest challenge and their greatest concern. The next highest was 55%, which was short-term shareholders driving extreme cost consciousness within markets. That was the second. And I think that's an interesting point. And it was juxtaposed with a lot of the conversations we have with CEOs who felt that the only scale of investment that is on the horizon, that's on the table in this next decade, is the investment that's already committed to fourth industrial revolution technologies. Technologies that are already engaged or that are already, already down on national investment plans, infrastructure plans, that are already on corporate plans in terms of investment in digital technologies, biological technologies, physical technologies like the shifts to clean energy. And so a lot of the conversation we had with CEOs was not about how do we find new investments to bridge that $4.5 trillion gap, but how do we arc the curve of some of these existing investments that are already committed, that are already budgeted, and how do we make those drive the sustainable development agenda? And I think there's a huge sweet spot in there for business to look not only at all of the additional capital that's required, it is required, and to look at the additional regulatory frameworks and policy mechanisms that are required, but also to look at the existing trillions of dollars that are earmarked for investment in technology and to think about how we use that differently and how we use that in a smart way to also deliver the sustainable development goals. So I will stop there. The answer from me is yes, it can. It has not to date, quite clearly. I think there is reason to be optimistic and things are moving faster than we've seen before. But it is going to take something akin to a Manhattan Project, a Marshall Plan, you know, something of that order of magnitude of all the different elements of society working together to minimize the downside risk and to find a pathway that gets us to 2030.
Great. Thank you so much. If you wouldn't mind taking the middle seat.
Oh, sure.
So can I get a quick show of hands? How many people believe that businesses can rise to the challenge?
Yep.
Great, so we have a bit of pre-existing optimism over here. So Peter, I'll be asking you a question later on about this phenomenon of tokenism. How do we deal with the perception? I don't know if it's a fact or not, but certainly a perception that a business can be an offender on 16 of the 17 SDGs and then, you know, expect to be congratulated for the wonderful things they are doing on the 17th one. So if we could just move the camera now into the panel. And I would now like to introduce Catherine Hurwitt for her opening remarks. Catherine is, I see her in the press mostly because of some battle that she has just won. Catherine is CEO of ShareAction and has been for over a decade. ShareAction is the UK's leading responsible investment group. There's a Financial Times article from last year in which, I don't know if it's the article that describes you or you've described yourself as both a gadfly and a helpmate to the global investment industry. I remember that it was the, what's it called, the Workplace
Disclosure Initiative?
Disclosure Initiative, yep. which is one of the feathers and the caps of ShareAction. I also remember not too long ago you guys pointing out that BlackRock, there's a bit of a disconnect between what they say and what their voting records are. And at the moment as we speak, you're fighting with Barclays about something, but I'll ask you to elaborate on that, please. So, ladies and gentlemen, Catherine Hurwitt.
Thank you, Lutfi. Excellent to be here. Excellent to be back, I should say, because I had a wonderful year being trained in many things that have helped me in my career here at LSE. So I'm also going to start with the question, can businesses rise to the challenge of helping the world to meet the sustainable development goals? And I agree that they can, but I think we also need to ask whether they will, and on that, I think the verdict is a lot less clear. So I would also, though, agree with Peter that we will absolutely not achieve the sustainable development goals without harnessing the best that business can bring. So they are a necessary condition, absolutely, that we get business on side, and business has all the tools, has all the ideas, has the people to make it happen. But they it's very far from clear that they will play that role. And so what I thought I would just briefly highlight are what I think are some of the conditions which would need to be met for business to step up. And the first of those is leadership within the business sector. And I feel very encouraged after hearing what Peter said about the fact that just in the last few weeks, business leaders seem to have woken up, that they have a really important role to play. They're not fully embracing the potential to make a difference. I actually think that just briefly on the whole question of leadership, we need a new generation of leadership. So I think the whole agenda around diversity in leadership is actually really instrumental and part of the conditions for success, that the leadership of global business looks a bit different from the people that are in the CEO roles today. And I would say that corporate leaders are attuned to, listening to, maybe not perfectly, an up-and-coming generation within their companies and people that, you know, may or may not join their company. So I think that's a really important factor and pressure. And I hear a lot of business leaders talking about how they're aware that, you know, talent may not join their companies unless their company has a really clear story and a credible story around sustainability. So I think that whole question of a different and better and more attuned leadership class within the business sector. So the second, by the way, I'll just point to Jeff Bezos as a really interesting example, high profile example, who, you know, only very recently, I think, has discovered that Amazon really needs to step up and has made some really quite impressive commitments in quite a short time. And I would lay the role that employees in the company have played in really quite an interesting example. So there's been a lot of really well-documented agitation from employees at Amazon, which I think is really very interesting dynamic that we'll probably see more of. So that's the first condition. The second condition is that we have good government, good policy making, and enforcement of laws. And by that's really not a given at all. There's some very bad governments around, and there's some better ones. And it's far from clear that we have the governments we need to step up. So that's another whole debate from whether we have the business. But if we don't have kind of good government, good lawmaking, good law enforcement, we certainly won't see business stepping up in the way that it could or should. So I think that's the second one. I won't say much more about that. But just one sort of example of that is, let's take just something really simple like minimum wage enforcement. You've got minimum wage regulation and laws in lots of countries, and it's just flouted. And so that creates obviously a bad environment in which businesses feel that they're being undercut by others that aren't sort of playing the game fairly. And, you know, that these sort of things absolutely require proper enforcement so that enlightened business can flourish. So the third condition is civil society engagement with business. I think civil society has played a really interesting role in the last two decades in nudging and holding accountable and making transparent business behaviour. And I think there's been a big shift where NGOs typically used to just nag governments, and now they nag companies just as much as they nag governments, and quite rightly too, because businesses have a role and responsibility in helping to solve the many challenges set out in the SDGs. So there's some really interesting new types of NGOs, digitally driven. Avaaz is an interesting example, but there's kind of 350.org is an interesting example, been doing amazing work to challenge business and finance on climate change. And there's some old players who are still really good, Oxfam, Greenpeace, and so on. So I think that that's an important part of the ecosystem. But the main thing I wanted to emphasize, which is the sort of field that I work on, is the role of investors, institutional investors. Because Peter alluded to the fact that there are still incredibly mixed signals coming out of the investment sector. And there's still a lot of fear and greed that motivates people that make decisions in the investment sector. But investors, institutional investors, in the last sort of four decades have risen enormously in terms of importance and in the role of capital allocators and capital stewards. So capital allocators, by that I mean just mean the decisions that are made to allocate money to one region of the world versus another in your pension portfolio, for example, or into one sector versus another. How much exposure do you want to fossil fuel energy versus how much exposure do you want to green energy? These are questions that institutional investors are constantly thinking about whilst trying to optimize returns over the long term. So that's what I mean by capital allocation. By capital stewardship, I mean that investors in companies, particularly equity investors, but bond investors have influence too, but equity investors have voting power, have influence, have access to boards and senior decision makers in companies. And the signals they send, particularly around this agenda, are really important. And I think it's really, I do engage a lot with the corporate community, but less than Peter, but I engage a lot with the investment sector. And I would say there too, something is shifting. Having worked in this area of responsible investment, nagging big pension funds and asset managers to be more engaged with sustainability for a really long, long period, it's kind of a moment of arrival, at least around that being acknowledged. But to Lutfi's point, there's a huge amount of nonsense, marketing and blather in the space of the responsible investment field. And everybody, let me give you one quite specific example. So one of the pieces of research that my organization Share Action is doing at the moment is a big analysis of the 75 largest fund managers globally. And we will publish shortly a ranking of these fund managers. These rankings are usually quite constructive and kind of nudging a bit of a debate. But every single one of the 75 are signatories to something called the Principles for Responsible Investment. So they're all card-carrying responsible investors on paper. But the reality is they're amazingly different and varied in terms of their actual engagement with driving sustainability thinking into the heart of their investment decision-making process, into the center of the dialogue they have with big companies, big company boards and CEOs. So I want to emphasize that whilst there's talk of stakeholder capitalism, and I welcome the Business Roundtable statement, the reality is that shareholders still do have a kind of absolutely central, critical and influential role. They are the ones that can vote directors on and off the boards of companies. They are the ones that can propose resolutions at company AGMs and help to create policy. And really, they have votes on executive remuneration, which is a really important role in designing incentives in business. So they do actually have a kind of central role, much as people might like to think that all stakeholders are important, all stakeholders are important, but shareholders, let's not be under any illusions, are kind of the most powerful on paper of all the kind of different stakeholders that companies have. And they can use and abuse, or they can accelerate and support the journey that companies go on this agenda. So I'm just going to finish with a little bit of an anecdote around this work that I'm doing at the moment on Barclays Bank. So Barclays Bank, I imagine a number of you are customers. I'm not a customer as it happens, but I am a shareholder in Barclays, along with a whole lot of other people who banded together to file a shareholder resolution just before Christmas. Under the UK Companies Act, shareholders can get together and put forward an idea to the company's management and board and to the rest of the shareholder base. And in this instance, the shareholder resolution that we have proposed is that Barclays should phase out financing of fossil fuel companies and energy companies who don't have a plan that's aligned with the goals of the Paris Agreement. So Barclays is the biggest banking entity in Europe financing the fossil fuel sector, the sixth biggest in the world, And a lot of, there's a really interesting and flourishing debate, particularly in the European banking sector, less in the US banking sector or the Asian banking sector, about the role that banks must play in financing and supporting a rapid decarbonisation of the economy. So we've put this to Barclays, and it's a really live situation. I'm in dialogue with Barclays board about this and have a number of meetings with the chairman, and I don't know what they're going to do, so I'm not really spilling any secrets. But what's really interesting is that yesterday there was a report in the FT of a pension fund called Nest. Has anyone heard of Nest? Yeah, they're a pension fund in the UK that was established a few years ago, and they have 9 million members. Most of those members are actually very low-income people in the UK that have been automatically enrolled into pension provision. And Nest, which is a kind of a government-backed investment entity, is growing by $500 million a month in terms of its asset pool. It's the fastest growing investment entity in the world. Not surprising when you think about all of the, you know, 9 million people once a month, something's going out of their paycheck into Nest. And Nest is adopting this very progressive approach to its kind of investment portfolio. And it's written a really pretty feisty letter to the Barclays board saying, we think that you should back this resolution, we'll be voting for it, and we'd actually like you to recommend it to global shareholders. So what you see is a pension fund that really represents very modest earning people taking a really progressive position, driven by their idea of their responsibility to act in those people's best interests, to invest in a way that really embraces the SDGs and the sustainable and the climate agenda. So I think that's, I don't know where it'll go. I don't know where we'll end up, Barclays, but I think that's an example of the type of enlightened, engaged, and pretty proactive investment behaviour that we need to see if we're going to in any way see business rise to the challenge.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you, Catherine. We love examples. The more we get them, the better. It's a bit awkward for me because I was going to very proudly say that LSE has recently become a signatory to the PRI. So I sit on the investment committee, and we, you know, very proudly signed up to that fairly recently. But Catherine's been telling me that it's almost outdated now. That, you know, it was
still good. Still
it
good.
Was the gold standard in its day. We now have the principles of responsible banking, which Barclays is a signatory to. So I really think you're pushing on an open door. At some point, they'll have to. It's going there. Okay. Speaking of banking. Julie Hudson. Julie is a former colleague. We used to work together at UBS. Julie Hudson is UBS Investment Bank's global head of ESG research. Last year, she completed 25 years at UBS. And this year is the 15th anniversary. Next month will be the 15th anniversary of her team's first publication called Why Try to Quantify the Unquantifiable? Which was about, I guess, ESG considerations. If you imagine the anatomy of an investment bank, you have sector-based analysts, and they're all looking at their respective sectors, looking at the mainstream metrics, and then you have Julie and her team sort of weaving through and getting them to also look at the wider issues because they just make sense. So highly pioneering 15 years ago. I saw recently that Julia's written a book on theatre, which I'm not really aware of, but I do remember the book that she co-authored, From Red to Green. How long ago was that?
That was 2011.
2011. I distinctly remember that because of the way she framed the environmental crisis as an analogue to the credit crisis, the credit crunch that we've just seen, and expressing how we live almost in the same way as you would describe somebody living on a credit card. So it's something like, I think, you know, we live within our means by June and July, and from August onwards, we're starting to borrow from future generations. And that framing was terrific, and again, you know, very pioneering at that time. So, Julie, over to you.
Okay, and certainly credit where credit's due. Paul Donovan and I were using a very well-known chart of the Global Footprint Network, which describes how many planets human beings are using up each year in terms of consuming renewable resources far more quickly than we can afford. And Paul is the economist in the writing team, and therefore it was actually his idea. I have to say, wanted to frame this as the idea of an environmental credit crunch. And I thought that was a fabulous idea, so we wrote the book together. And I'll perhaps go a little bit further back and recount how I happened to start working in this field of ESG and sustainable investing. And it was because in my early years, when I was learning all about markets and finance, I just found the whole thing really puzzling. Because on the one hand, everybody was teaching me about the efficient market hypothesis and the capital asset pricing model. And you learned all about the Chicago School of Economics and how an efficient economy would allocate resources in an efficient way. And yet, periodically, you would get these quite spectacular crashes in markets, and you would get market failures. And I just kept walking around thinking, okay, so why do markets fail, right? If they're so perfect and if they're so inefficient, why do they fail? And I did a whole lot of different things. I was being teased about having a number of degrees as we came into the room. And it's because I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do a master's degree because that's a way of learning something really quickly. So I did a master's in financial economics, and I thought, no, it's not there. And I did an MBA, and I thought, no, I still haven't found it. I still don't understand why markets fail. And then I found a master's in economic regulation and competition. And I thought, now I'm beginning to understand this. And it's basically because business, markets, society are all trying to move forward. And you have these sort of negotiations that go on whenever there are externalized costs. And that's when I really began to get into this and understand it. And then in 2006, the CFA Institute asked if I'd write a monograph for the foundation. And I did. And the punchline really was, the responsibility of the investment profession, which is the title of the monograph, is to decide when markets will fail and when markets can deliver. Because there are times when markets do a fabulous job of bringing capital to where it's needed and delivering the goods and services and benefits that society needs. But there are also times when markets do a very bad job of that. And moving on from that, I guess the next important thing I read was really the work of Donella Meadows, who was part of that Club of Rome team that wrote all about growth within limits. And Donella Meadows wrote a primer called about systems thinking, which is, of course, this is a very good place in which to think about systems thinking. And because of her, I now look at everything as a kind of ecosystem. And I do this because, and I'm going to take a slightly different tack to the previous speaker, markets are astonishing. I've always been very interested in them and loved them, and it doesn't matter whether it's the fruit market on the weekend or whether it's securities markets during the week. I think they're quite amazing in terms of being able to bring people together and needs together and to move capital very efficiently. So I thought, okay, if you think about markets as ecosystems, well, they're just like any other system. So you have natural ecosystems, human ecosystems, societal ecosystems, market ecosystems. And sometimes you get feedback loops that are very constructive, and sometimes you get very destructive ones. And anybody who is working in markets on a day-to-day basis knows what it's like when one of those feedback loops gets hold of you and either takes your portfolio off in an amazing way and you outperform, or it takes it off down in the other direction and you crash. And of course, within that at the same time, companies are delivering innovations driven by markets which allow you to get somewhere. So we recently wrote a piece in response to a piece of science that talked about the potential cascade of tipping points, which I found a really frightening article. I don't know if anybody else has read it. Basically arguing that climate science has got to the point where it's clear that a number of these different systems, so whether it's the temperature or what's happening to sea ice or what's happening to the sea and the increasing acidity of the oceans and what's happening to food systems and land systems, the danger they highlighted is there could be a cascade of tipping points where everything goes in a very adverse direction all at the same time and becomes impossible to stop. And we stepped back from that and said, well, that is really frightening. What can we do about it? What can markets do about it? Markets are capable of delivering a cascade of tipping points. And if you got enough innovations, so the sort of thing you were just talking about in technology, and you they were happening all at the same time, you could actually create a system going in the opposite direction. And so how does one do that? So every day I watch the market and I listen to what UBS analysts are publishing. And in 2014, I went across to the States and all of my clients were talking about fossil fuel exclusion, disinvestment. And I came back and there was an amazing piece of research from three UBS sector teams, the autos, materials, chemicals teams. Ever since then, I have called it the Energy Revolution Note. And what they described was really a prototype for fossil fuel-free car travel. At a time when people are still laughing at the idea that the combustion engine can go obsolete. And since then, the same teams have written something called the Electric Vehicle Teardown. And what they literally did was to work with a group of data scientists within my firm called UBS Evidence Lab. They took apart a Chevy Bolt a couple of years ago because they wanted to see what was in it and what it would cost for an EV to be deliverable and affordable. And we were able to come up with a piece of research which said, basically, this has a real momentum behind it. Now, I'm not going to be naive about this and say the electric vehicle is the solution to everything, because clearly it is not. So, for example, with the MIT guys recently, every year we sponsor the MIT Sustainability Summit, and one discussion in a mobility session around that was the fact that actually the market systems that are propelling things forwards in a very fast momentum way, of course they're propelling the innovation which reduces CO2 emissions, but they're also propelling this tendency of human beings to consume. So if you go across to an electric vehicle, to an electric vehicle driven system, but then you end up with more and more and more electric vehicles because everybody is in love with their car and wants to use their car as an office and does millions and millions more journeys, you end up where you started. You might have a clean car system, but you're still very resource intensive as an economy. And by the way, this was just really a sort of simulation in the discussion. So there are lots of things to fix there. And then, of course, I won't go on about things like there are batteries that are driving that system and you need to think about the supply chains and all of that. So that's one instance where, yes, market innovation can drive things, but somebody needs to think about where we're trying to get, which connects into the idea of corporate purpose. So somebody needs to be thinking about what direction we're driving in so we don't go off a cliff. Second very example I'll just talk about is in a completely different sector. UBS analysts have recently written The Future of Food, 1, 2, and 3, so three blockbuster reports. And the second one was written by the chemicals team. And I went together with one of the analysts, Andrew Sott, to do a presentation to clients. And I did the ESG introduction, and he talked about plant-based meat, which is helping to catalyze a reduction in meat eating. And he talked about gene editing, which is helping to produce more productive seeds. And by the way, gene editing is not like GMOs because universities own the IP and are selling it broadly, which means actually many will have access to that. But it wasn't that. It wasn't the innovations that were so mesmerizing in Andrew's presentation. The most exciting bit was a chart forecasting grain inventories. Now, you might think that was the most boring possible chart with nothing to do with ESG. So the base case forecast is for grain inventories to go up towards the top right-hand side of the chart. And Andrew's discussion was these innovations will reduce, well, basically will result in a surplus of grain, which will produce a supply response, which will end up taking land out of the system. And the reason for that is the less meat you eat, the less grain you need with a multiplier, because it takes about 7 times as much grain to produce the meat as it does if you just eat the grain. And I looked at that chart and thought that chart is actually about innovation, the power of innovation to produce these really positive, powerful feedback loops. Because by taking land out of the system, that's basically helping to contribute towards climate change goals, and it's relevant, of course, to the sustainable development goals, even if those innovations were not put together with a particular goal in mind. So I think we need to, one thing to do, one more to go across to the positives that we're trying to get to, is to think about the fact that markets are actually a really powerful ecosystem that can deliver these ideas. Participants basically need to have in mind that purpose and know where we're trying to get, know where the destination is, to recognize those ideas when they come through. Because, by the way, I've also just written a note to say that innovation and its impact on land use would not fit into the EU sustainable taxonomy. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Julie. And just to... Yeah, let's do that. Give a round of applause. To just you know, put this into context, the UBS as a group manages over $1 trillion of assets under management. So when you get a research note of that kind that is revolutionary, that's ahead of its time, even if a small percentage of those assets are directed towards these themes, it's a great impact. It's a tremendous impact. Okay, now last but not least, our very own Dr. Mary Martin. Mary is with LSE Ideas. She's director of the UN Business and Human Security Initiative. I found it fascinating learning about this particular niche that she works on, which is how do you crowd in private business in fragile and post-conflict situations. And they have a framework, a wonderful framework that assists in doing that, because if it's not done correctly, you could very, very easily end up unraveling delicate peace situations and doing more harm than good. So you do need a well-considered, well-researched framework to go there, and that's one of the things that she do. Mary also has a new book, which is sitting over there. It's called Corporate Peace: How Global Business Shapes a Hostile World. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mary Martin.
Thank you, Lutfi. I'm conscious I seem to have my back to some of you, so this great format. Let me offer a couple of reflections, really, as a counterpoint to the really interesting remarks we've heard so far. By starting, going back a bit to think, what is the challenge that's implicit in this 2030 agenda and the sustainable development goals, and perhaps why it's so difficult, as Peter alluded to, that, you know, the businesses aren't making the progress, or perhaps they won't even make the progress. And I mean, Peter's talked about, you know, Davos and the high peaks of finance, and even Julie and Catherine are perhaps a perspective from the skyscrapers of London or New York. I'd like to offer you not the bird's eye view, but the worm's eye view, as we call it, how it looks from the ground. And something that Peter mentioned, which I think is critical in this, is the issue of trust and the image of business and the confidence that the rest of the world has that business can deliver on this. I think there are several types of challenge implicit in the SDG agenda. Two are in parallel. First, and you may find this surprising because my project is with the UN and it's called the UN Business and Human Security Initiative, but I have a real problem with the way the UN has and continues to its attitude towards the private sector. The framework itself was, I was going to say, an implicit, perhaps a very explicit attempt by the UN to co-opt the private sector as the financiers of last resort, if you like, for a very ambitious agenda. And Peter's given us some figures about how expensive that was. But if you go back before when this started, the SDG goals were set out, the predominant attitude of the UN and a lot of governments and policy towards the private sector was to see them as abusive, a global governance problem because of human rights abuses. And suddenly there's a 180-degree switch. You know, we need their money. And So I think for business, actually, the SDG agenda is quite confusing. I think it's also confusing. It's all very well to talk about large global companies, but for the vast mainstream of national, less global leaders, it's a forest of signaling about, you know, what needs to be done, what they should do, how they should contribute, but actually a lack of concrete guidance on how to get there. Both on the choice of goals, which is problematic, lots of criticisms about businesses cherry-picking goals that suit them, and I'll come back to that, and just the methods for achieving the targets that are there. But clearly the fact that the global private sector has responded and has responded so positively, and it is really encouraging to hear what Peter and others are saying about the positive reaction, I think reflects the second challenge that my colleagues on the panel have also pointed to, this increasing public expectation and calls for a new kind of business model of capitalism. And that has multiple sources. It lies in the financial crash, the environmental movement, plus also, it has to be said, the abuses that we continue to see, whether it's in terms of not paying taxes or on human rights or whatever. And as Catherine has pointed out very well, you know, it's the investors who are now driving this change also in public expectations, urging a kind of social purpose to be in there. But in, if you like, responding to that pivot, in making that pivot, the question is how. Again, it's not so much what, but it's how. And I think there's a sort of fundamental, there's a conceptual question as well, which is that how businesses actually should see sustainability. You can have almost as many, clearly as many as there are development goals and as many as there are targets, definitions of what sustainability means, from environment to all kinds of other things. But I think the fundamental tension and dichotomy remains, is it something that is going to deliver better costs, better profits for the business, or is it somehow that they need to max up on social philanthropy and corporate social responsibility? So I think this is quite confusing for a lot of, you know, smaller businesses as well, as to what does this sustainability agenda mean. And I think what it does require is companies often moving into new and sometimes quite difficult new terrain and finding comfort zones in that. I remember talking to a very large extractive multinational. He said, well, we know we mustn't abuse, we know we have to comply with certain standards, and now we're being told that we should be development actors. Between that very broad spectrum, where do we want to be in that, and how do we act? And I think that's a question that is still very relevant for a lot of the private sector. I think in the area I work, which is thinking about what business could do in fragile and conflict-affected zones, if you take the example of SDG 16, which is the one on peace, justice, and strong institutions, it's probably quite a good example of where companies need to and can shift their horizons and find some new terrain. SDG 16 has consistently, over the last sort of 5 years or more, been amongst the least popular SDGs. The take-up is something like 22-23%, compared with climate change, which is the most popular, where uptake levels are, I'm probably out of date, but sort of 65% or something, or gender, or decent work, so 8
five.
Which one? Five, yes, thank you. And the other ones that actually interestingly rank very low are the number two, which is on zero hunger, also ones on life, to do with life on land and life under the sea. And they have the same levels of uptake as SDG 16, quite poor. And I wonder why that is. Is it because they're seen as very vague? Or perhaps it's just seen as the work, not of the private sector, but it's something that governments really need to be doing. Another reflection is that what we get told all the time by companies is, well, we don't work in fragile and conflict affected zones. So SDG 16, it's not really relevant to us, for example. If you take the World Bank definition of fragile and conflict affected, it covers huge swathes of markets where most most large companies, certainly most global companies, probably want to be. The World Bank definition is that it's where there are cycles of violence, weak governance, and instability. And that probably covers Mexico, large parts of Latin America, South Asia, and certainly Africa, where, you know, there are huge potential consumer markets, not to mention natural resources. But I think there are things that business can do to reverse the trends which see that if we do nothing, by 2035, 85% of the world's poorest people will be living in those zones as well. And I think that is something that business has to pick up and act on, whether it's through SDG 16 or a combination of some of the other goals. I think going back to the point that there's still a lack of concrete guidance is that if you look at the guidance to business in conflict, fragile and conflict-affected zones, it has to do with human rights due diligence. It has to do with sort of do no harm. And it ignores a huge positive agenda that I think is emerging and that business can grasp. If you think about the targets within SDG 16, just as an example, it's things like providing legal IDs to workers. It's protecting child workers. It's the non-discrimination of minorities. These are all kind of crossing points where business has something to say. And I think I would say that it's not, going back to my first point about this sort of ambiguous attitude of the UN and government to working with business. I think the point to recognize is that business has assets which are not just financial. They're not just a cash cow. They have attributes which include, there's a problem-solving mentality if you're in the private sector, which is incredibly useful. Often the business cycle, the investment cycle, may actually be longer than the political cycle, if you think about three-yearly, four-yearly elections, which makes it very valuable to have a business contribution. And I think, and the key point I want to make, which goes to my point about the worm's eye view, is that businesses, large, very large, but also slightly smaller, are often the presence on the ground. They have local knowledge. They have a day-to-day interaction with the very people that these development goals are designed to benefit. And I think if I have one concern about whether businesses can rise to this challenge, it is in the disconnect that we still see between the global rhetoric, which is really ramped up and is very welcome, and actually what companies do on the ground. And I think for that, what we need is for companies to really rethink their relations to communities, whether they're in the developed world, the underdeveloped world, in conflict-affected zones, all over. Because the trust factor that was so undermined, has been so undermined over the last 10, 15, 20 years in particular, but really going back for a long time, all the time that businesses said the only business of business is business or to make profits. I think to rebuild that trust, to have a kind of mutually reinforcing and, to coin a phrase, sustaining relationship with communities is what business now needs to do to really deliver on these goals.
Thank you so much, Mary. So I'm going to... So we have about 20 minutes. I'm going to skip my questions. I'll come back to them if the room runs dry. But I'll go straight to questions from the floor. I'm going to try and be as scientific as possible without any tools at my disposal. But I did see this hand here first. If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, please, and if you could direct the question to one panelist. We'll try and keep this as fast-paced as possible.
Okay, thank you. I am Laura Trevino. I'm a student from the Master's Development Studies at LSE. I have a question. I would say anybody can answer it. It's just about bringing these UN standard of the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, which was even adopted before the 2030 agenda. And I mean, SDGs are translated into human rights. So I would like to know your views of how the human rights due diligence that business are supposed to do according to this standard can serve on contributing to SDGs attainment from the private sector.
Anyone here would like to volunteer to answer that? Mary?
Should I take that one? Thank you, Laura. Yeah, I think these are essential preliminary stepping stones. I mean, the UNGP system isn't perfect, but I think for me, I've been working on this sort of stuff for about 15 years now, and that marked a real breakthrough in kind of public awareness and with a framework that serves as it. But I would say that we're accelerating way beyond that. So human rights due diligence and the UNGPs are a basic minimum, but we can go so much further than that. And the positive agenda that I was mentioning, that's why we focus on what we call human security. Human rights is an essential part of human security, but I think, you know, it can be so much more. And I think the advantage of something like human security, which, I mean, is a UN term, but let's call it well-being or you know, human development, I think is that it shouldn't just be seen as compliance, which human rights often is, with companies having their backs against the wall, I've got to tick this box. I think we want to shift that mindset to imagining how business and society and communities can be co-constructors of a sustainable future.
Thank you. Next question from this side, the gentleman over there.
Hi, Scrum Bennett Clemo. I'm a consultant at Jones Lang LaSalle. You mentioned the cascades and the feedback loop effect, which I think are wonderfully depicted in David Wallace Wells' The Uninhabitable Earth. If we do hit this tipping point, we will reach a point where all of the sustainable development goals are unreachable. Now, do you think we need to prioritize focusing on reducing greenhouse emissions and global warming?
Anyone particularly would like to answer this?
I mean, it's open. It's an open question. So,
Julie or Peter, who would like to? Julie? You mentioned cascades, so it's yours.
Exactly, and I was thinking about climate change. Yeah. Very clearly, that must be a hugely important and priority issue for absolutely everybody. You're quite right that we can't afford to go down that pathway of climate change, the climate change cascade of tipping points. We need to try and offset that in some way through basically a different culture and different behaviours, societally speaking, in which there's less of a culture of consuming and consuming without really thinking about it. And I mean, the SDGs themselves are actually also a system. So you can't really pick one goal and try and meet that. So, for example, if you try and meet goal number 7, which is about clean energy, of course, it's also about clean, affordable energy. So unless what you're doing also supports decent jobs, a decent place to live, decent infrastructure that can deliver the energy, you're not getting there. And, of course, decent energy, clean energy would mean low carbon energy delivered in a system that is also low carbon and resource efficient. So when you ask a great question, because it's a complicated problem. But I think you're absolutely right.
Sorry, Peter, you wanted to come in?
I think Julie answered very well. So the only thing I would add is I do think, so it is a systems issue and it can't be solved simply by prioritizing one part of the system. But I do think that climate is a primus inter pares, you know, is a first amongst equals topic that does deserve, what do you say, more, but certainly an incredible focus as a Rosetta Stone issue, if you like. I think one of the reasons it's an interesting point you made about the uptake of SDGs, about the climate change versus the other themes. I do think that climate, relative to all of the other issues, is something that actually took the uptake to be 100%, actually, because it is one of those issues that does cut across all sectors. If you look at the other 17 and you cut down to the next 163, not every issue does touch every industry and every sector material or every company's footprint, whereas carbon and climate change does. And so I think, given the materiality of the issue to humanity and the materiality across industries, it really should be at 100% uptake, not at 65%.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Ethical and sustainable supply chains. So Mary touched on the point of building trust with communities, and that means, so we're seeing a lot of pressure from investors and consumers for visibility across supply chains and across companies' operations. And we have the technology today to enable that visibility, so blockchain through tracking and traceability. But if companies were to take on blockchain, that means more public disclosure of their operations. That means open and fluid value networks, which stands in stark opposition to any strategic behaviors we've seen to date. So sort of trying to gain competitive advantage. In your conversations with C-suites, are they ready for that openness and vulnerability?
I don't know if I'm allowed to use this quote because it's been recorded, but one CEO of a retailer I was with recently, I thought put it brilliantly, which was that on ethical supply chains, responsible business issues in the supply chain, sustainability, more from an environmental perspective, he said, what you have to think of is that the sustainability and responsible business pressures are crashing into waves of digital development and transparency and technology. And what he said was, you don't get a choice, right? In 3 to 5 years, you're going to be naked, and if you're going to be naked, you better be buff, right? which is, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that. But the idea from a responsible sustainability perspective is you should be making sure you have to assume radical transparency from now on. You have to assume that, and it's, look, by the way, it is radically transparent. I can show you systems that we have to go and scrape social data to look at any supply chain. We can pinpoint human rights abuses in an individual factory, in an individual country, in an individual, it is already transparent. The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed, as the phrase goes, right? And so that radical transparency is here. It'll just be that it becomes more and more the case. So to some extent, I think they do get it. I don't think anyone questions it. I think the question is often about pace and scale, but I think you get less people resist it these days. I just wanted to come back to something. I think this issue of the climate point that you made, I think it's very interesting. I think if you are from the CEO study, from the UN CEO study, the two issues that came back from CEOs were climate and inequality over anything else by a long, long way. And I think those speak to the fragile nature of capitalism, plus the technology situation, plus the SDGs. Because to your point about jobs and economic development, all the things we need from an economy, if you don't have both of those two things, actually the system can just disintegrate either way. So I think you have both of those they're probably the two issues, at least in the perception of CEOs, are the most important to tackle. And that we haven't tackled, and that there's a lack of trust in the system because it has delivered over 40 years. If you look at the US, the UK, since Reaganomics, Thatcheromics, look at the average, the average increase for the average working class family in terms of wages and so on, so quality of jobs, etc. So you can't. It's one of those two things. Either of those two could destabilize the system if we don't find a way to bring them together. And I think that happens in a world where you have multiple different forms of disruptive technologies, but there are three that are also primus inter pares. I think the point, yeah, there's a series of low carbon technologies, electric vehicles and, the, you know, and clean energy is one. But I think if you look at artificial intelligence, and then you look at genomics and mapping, you know, everything on Earth, everything and, you know, every living thing, you take, it's an extraordinary time where we could see it rapidly spiral out of control, even on top of all the climate feedbacks, which is based on the systemic issues I've just mentioned there, or they could be the solution to the problems that we face. And that's the point about the technology point that I just go back to, is that we have to focus on those three or four different technology themes and find ways of arcing the curve of their trajectory and how we invest in those, how we build the guardrails around them, how we work on those as societal, you know, different players in society. Or I don't believe business will rise to the challenge. I personally, maybe this is a bit controversial, unless we can harness those technologies in the next 10 years to deliver sustainable development, those three I've just mentioned, I don't think we'll do it.
But if people want to tweet that quote, I think it might actually make people more. So over here, sir.
Yes, thanks for that most encouraging delivery by the those in the front line, went to the speakers. But mine is an open question regarding a number of issues in terms of systemic issues. For instance, the World Economic Forum mentioned UN and NGOs and transnational corporations, for instance. My main issue is the question of mismanaging the global economy, as we've had over 280 years of capitalism. And one speaker mentioned the challenge and a new type of capitalism to somehow evolve post fourth industrial revolution. In your experience, can we still, as a global family, leave everything to the market and wait for some kind of nirvana to evolve as a result? Or have we reached a crossing point, a new, not merely a new type of capitalism, but a new world order in terms of people first?
Thank you.
And capital setting the agendas.
Great question, Catherine.
That's a daunting, daunting question, although a really interesting one. Well, I just wanted to link it back to what Peter said about climate and inequality being the two things that business leaders threw up most, because I think that's really interesting, because I think embedded in the model of capitalism we're all still part of is kind of the production of externalities, which are really dangerous, and climate change is all about that. And embedded in the version of capitalism we have today is the inequality just gets bigger and bigger, because the returns to capital are much higher than the returns to labor. So if you've got capital, you just keep acquiring and building and you get richer and richer. And so it's absolutely valid to ask, hold on, should we be looking to this system to solve all these problems? And I grapple with this the whole time at Share Action. And I think that ultimately probably no. And I think we're probably going to have some really ugly shakeouts and crises that will kind of create political will and interest for more radical solutions that probably are going to be needed. At the same time, it's very encouraging that people in business and people in investment are really concerned about these questions about, you know, what's being produced as a byproduct negatively of the way they go about things. And I want to just come back to this word that I think Julie mentioned, which is purpose.
I jotted that down too.
I think that's at the moment the purpose of business, but this is very fundamentally under assault at the moment, is just to make money. And so all this, you know, magnificent innovation, technology, it needs to be harnessed to a higher purpose that somehow society needs to define. And each company needs to define for itself. And we're kind of, that's a debate at the moment, but still not the kind of lived reality of what goes on day to day in business. And there are just huge incentives in terms of people's careers, in terms of, you know, people's access to capital, in business to just pursue profitability above all and any other purpose. And so I think somehow we really need to. And you know, it's really interesting that Larry Fink, who is the CEO of the world's largest fund manager, not a company that I love or admire particularly, and in fact my organization spends quite a bit of time, you know, poking them for and challenging them on certain hypocritical statements, but it's nevertheless a great sign of the times that the CEO of that company feels the need to send a letter to the CEOs of all of the companies in his portfolios, in the portfolios of that company, which is basically every large company in the world, asking them to define their purpose in a higher, you know, in a bigger frame than just profitability. So they're kind of, the signs are there, but you're so right to challenge and question whether these entities are really capable of reinventing themselves. And I don't know.
Yeah, and it might be, I mean, I think that's the perfect way of reconciling the two points, which is, to your point, purpose, and your point, I think, was, if I jotted it down right, that it's that at the moment we have markets that are working but are not necessarily grounded in purpose and not an active discussion about what their purpose is, which is, I think, what you said. And I think, you know, so there's markets in a vacuum, almost, like markets for the sake of markets. And I think if you take that purpose piece in capitalism, I think that's what it will have to look like, whether it's called capitalism or, you know, actually capital, there are three types of capital: physical capital, human capital, and financial capital. If anything, probably in the next iteration of capitalism, we may want to rebalance that to be far more focused on the human capital and the physical capital and what we've done to it, rather than the financial capital and what the potential is of the natural environment as the physical capital, human capital as people. So I think, you know, I think that there's a lot to that statement about purpose and markets and purpose, because I do think it is by far the least worst and most durable way of organizing society that we have found so far in recent decades. But it is not delivering on the challenges that society faces. Again, it sort of comes, can it rise? Take out can businesses. Can capitalism rise to the challenge? I think yes, but it'll have to be massively rebalanced towards delivering on this purpose that we talked about.
And it might just be worth throwing into the pot the whole design of economics and GDP measurement.
For sure.
Very interested in comment that we have all these innovations going on in technology, and yet GDP has just been kind of bubbling along.
Yeah, we don't measure it properly, yeah.
But actually, are we measuring the right thing?
No, absolutely.
And if you had a cultural change so that you measure what really matters in terms of what's being produced within the economy, might you then have a change in corporate culture?
Yep.
I need to ask somebody who's a student or an affiliate with the LSC over here, amongst the people who want to ask a question. Please.
Hi, I'm Margarita. I work for LSC Ideas as well as for Amnesty International UK as a research for business and human rights. And I think it was great that all the panelists seem to agree that businesses need to be at the center of the trying to achieve the development goals. At the same time, I feel like at the higher levels, the mindset is still very much state-centered. So, for example, states that need to report to the UN about the SDGs or like level of achievement, and more generally translating the SDGs in human rights, businesses are not being held accountable under international law for human rights violations. So how do you think it's possible to translate sort of like this state, very much state-centered mindset, into something that actually puts businesses at the fore, or civil society in general, actually? Is it something that can be done top-down, or does it need to be bottom-up?
I mean, the only thing I'll say, I don't know. I think that issue I mentioned about businesses being very nervous about political uncertainty in the next 3 to 5 years and the apparent undermining of multilateralism by some of the big forces in biggest actors that you talk about, means that we may not have a choice from a top-down perspective. And I think there is a growing realization, and I really, you know, really having those conversations behind closed doors, which says, we've got 10 years to fix this. If you wait around for governments to fix this, you can forget it. Right. And it'll be on our watch as CEOs. So I think there are a number of CEOs. I'm not saying it's across the board. I'm not saying there aren't still examples of companies that are still trying to arbitrage the system and are trying to make everything they can out of it. But there are a group of the very biggest CEOs that, if these societies collapse, and if these systems collapse, what business are you going to do? Right? If you're the biggest industry player and you're You know, in take the sort of main 20, 30 industries in the world. If you know the world is falling apart around you, what business are you doing? What growth are you going to drive? What benefit are you? And I think, you know, I think we have talked about it a little bit. I think, you know, this is also for a lot of you, you know, who are coming through as the next generation of leaders. And you mentioned this, Catherine. You know, that we need another generation of leaders and a different type of leaders than we've had before. You know, I think this is something that you're going to have to be able to help us square the circle with different skills, different mindsets, different attitudes. I think that's starting to take hold already amongst existing leaders, recognizing that they have not necessarily the right knowledge, skills, attitudes, mindsets to solve some of these problems. But I think a lot of you can bring some of that problem-solving mentality to bear and try and work out how we square the circle on some of these issues. And I will say one of the biggest surprises for me out of the CEO study this time round was the number of CEOs. And I'm going to say, I haven't looked at it exactly, but we did 121 one-to-ones, and I did 80 of those. And I would say around 50% of those at some point mentioned their children putting pressure on them as CEOs. And I've never heard that before. Never. Right? I mean, you're talking like one or two in the average. And I've done that study every 3 years since 2006. And this is the first time. So don't forget, you know, if your mums and dads are in important positions, you know, give them a bloody hard time.
So I'm getting dagger eyes from people all over. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but we're breaking for drinks outside. And please do approach members of the panel with the questions. If you'd like to drop me an email, if you're still unable to get your question through and would like to drop me an email, I'll try and get an answer back to you if I can. But I think for now we should wrap it up. But the one other thing as we go into... That's right. So two other things. There are five people who asked questions and there are five Kindles. So please come and grab me afterwards and you can get your Kindles. If I could also point out...
I should say that they're also... The reason they're Kindles... So the book is published next week. It's not in hard copy. But from a circular economy perspective, you can get 1,000 books on a Kindle. You'll find that the cover is recovered and recycled clothing and bottles and so on. So it's supposed to be a more circular use of materials for delivering books.
Great. And one last thing. We have, I just saw sitting over there, Paul Smith, the recently retired CEO and president of CFA Institute. Paul came to LSE to deliver a talk in another part of LSE and very kindly came to join us immediately afterwards. He'll be joining us for drinks outside. So please do direct some of his questions to him as well. Paul, welcome. And with that, let's just say thank you to the panel as well and hope to see you all outside. Thank you very much. Thank you.